Can I ask everyone to take their seats, please, so we can get started on our next presentation and stay close to our schedule. We're doing pretty well, and I just want to make sure that that we do that. For those of you who are just joining us for this session, I'm Christopher Manfredi, the Dean of the Faculty of Arts at McGill, of which the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada is an integral part. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our next guest to you. I'll be introducing her and then moderating a short question and answer period after her presentation. Ms. Liz Hanna has come to us from Calgary today, full disclosure, my sort of hometown, to be with us here today. She is the Vice President of Communications for Cenovus Energy Company. Cenovus Energy is a Canadian integrated oil company. Its operations include oil sands projects in northern Alberta, which use specialized methods to drill and pump the oil to the surface, and natural gas and oil production in Alberta and Saskatchewan. The company also has 50% ownership in two U.S. refineries. Ms. Hanna now joins us to give a special presentation, more of the story, standing up for oil. I'd like to welcome to the podium Liz Hanna.
Thanks, Chris. Good afternoon, everyone. My talk is based on the qualitative research that we've done across the country to find out what Canadians feel, think, and are concerned about oil, and to make sure that we understand what their opinions are about the oil sands and Canada's role as an energy provider. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is just make sure that it's very clear what my position is. I heart oil. This T-shirt is a symbol of my pride in the responsible way that we're developing that resource. Through innovation, our advanced technology, and our commitment to keep getting better. Access to reliable, affordable energy is one of the defining characteristics of modern society, with oil being the form of energy that's consumed more than any other in the world, for all kinds of reasons. As Christopher Reagan mentioned, its versatility means it can be used to generate electricity. It can be used to heat and cool our homes. It's the feedstock for thousands of products we use and rely on every day. And, of course, it's the fuel for the world's transportation needs. I grew up in Malawi. It's one of the poorest countries in Africa. In fact, in 2011, it ranked as the ninth poorest country in the world. It has a GDP per capita of $860. I've seen how people live without modern energy. They're using things like wood, charcoal, even dung to cook their food. So I know there's not much in this world that's as critical to our lives as oil. Not having what oil provides us would mean huge change, as was discussed in the first panel. What I think we have to remember is that we are incredibly lucky to have such an abundance of energy in this country. Oil, natural gas, your great hydro resource here in Quebec. Every country that doesn't have enough country knows how fortunate we are. Every day, just by flicking a switch, the lights come on. Our computers boot up. We have heat in our homes and food from around the world in our grocery stores. The very quality of our lives in Canada depends on energy sources that we take for granted every day. Energy sources that are developed with the most advanced technology available. Yet oil has become a lightning rod. It's been protested against. It's been trash-talked by celebrities. It's been cast as a villain. You only have to open a newspaper or follow the commentary on social media to know that most of the information out there is skewed decidedly to the negative. especially about the oil sands. That overwhelming negativity has created the impression that Canadians as a whole are against oil. Yet every poll that I've seen that's been conducted since Cenovus was formed in December of 2009 shows that's not the case. The majority of Canadians, 80%, are either supportive or undecided about the oil sands. That's not to say they don't have concerns, because they do. They want assurances, like we all do, that they're being developed responsibly. For us, the question is this. If so many Canadians are either supportive or undecided about the oil sands, why isn't the dialogue more balanced? Why aren't more people engaged in the issue? In 2010, we commissioned a research firm to conduct a series of workshops for us across Canada to help us understand that. We held two workshops in each of five cities, Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg, here in Montreal, and in Toronto, with 30 people participating in each one, 10 who were on the pro side, 10 who were neutral, and 10 who were on the opposing side. With each workshop being 3 hours long, it was a pretty big time commitment, yet every one of the participants was fully engaged in the exercises they were given, and they were committed to ensuring that we knew and understood what their thoughts were, what their views were, and what their concerns were. And we did a second set in December 2012. This is what we learned. People are busy with their increasingly complicated lives, so much so that many aren't even aware that energy has become an issue. When the facilitators raised the idea of energy being an issue in Canada, there was a general feeling that they just didn't need to engage, because smart minds, and they feel we have a lot of them in Canada, would prevail and sort things out. We also learned, no surprise here, that most of the information about the industry and energy issues is way too technical and detailed. They are drowning in information. We decided to test that further. We put some examples in front of them, excerpts from newspapers, websites, brochures, including some of ours, and pretty much across the board, they didn't like any of them. They found them difficult to understand. They were written in a way that assumed knowledge that they didn't have. There was way too little context for the information and facts provided. They weren't presented in a way that's capturing their interest. There really is a consequence for being a 140-character society. We learned that people's mistrust has grown. They're skeptical of big oil. They're skeptical of government. They're even skeptical of what they hear and see in the media. And most of all, they're skeptical of the hyperbole from anti-oil groups. Claims like, is game over for the planet if we develop the oil sands? What it boils down to is they're just plain tired of polarized views. It's all just becoming noise. They can't tell from the huge mix of information and misinformation that's out there what's true and what's not. And basically, they're confused. People also feel conflicted. They know how essential oil is to their lives, but it's getting harder and harder for them to believe that oil is being developed responsibly. All they hear is about how badly it's being developed. We also learned that people know very little about our natural resources, especially about the oil sands, less even than we assumed going in. They've heard of or seen pictures of the mining projects. And they're very aware of the outrageous things being said about the oil sands, but that's pretty much about it. Very few knew even the basics, that there are two ways to get the oil out, mining and drilling, depending on whether the oil is close to the surface or deep underground, or that only 20% of that vast resource will be mined, because 80% of the oil is deep underground and can only be extracted using drilling techniques. And lastly, time after time, people in the workshops who had identified themselves as pro-oil or even neutral got quieter and quieter as negative opinions became more emotional. So what did we conclude? Because Canadians know so little about oil, they aren't seeing themselves as stakeholders of Canada's energy, as people who should be informed about all sides of the story, who should have an opinion about our resources, and who should feel confident stating their opinion, no matter what it is. Canadians need to know basic facts. There isn't enough energy for what the world needs now, never mind in the future. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, world energy demand is expected to increase 56% over the next three decades. We can only meet that demand if every form of energy is used: natural gas, coal, nuclear, renewables like wind, solar, and hydro, new forms of energy, I'm sure hemp is in there somewhere, and of course, oil. Because we are nowhere near being able to replace oil, we have no other energy source that comes close to matching oil's versatility and affordability. A few years ago, I took my family to see where I grew up. We traveled through East Africa in a bus named Elvis, and I was struck by how 30 years later, so much had changed, and yet so much was still the same. Unreliable electricity, charcoal being sold by the side of the road, people still carrying water from a communal pump. I think we'd all agree. Everybody, everywhere, deserves energy and a life beyond subsistence. So how can we, Canadians, in all good conscience, even suggest that the oil sands, the third largest oil resource on the planet, not have a role? How many countries are there in the world that would think it's a good idea to leave such a vast energy resource in the ground instead of developing it? Our focus is on doing even better than we're doing today. The Canadian oil and gas industry is among the most highly regulated in the world, with some of the most transparent reporting standards. Those regulations have set a high standard to ensure we get even better at what we do. And we are getting better all the time. A big reason for that is the world-class technology used. Our CEO, Brian Ferguson, often describes our company as a technology company because of the emphasis we have on innovation and technology development. Over the next decade, oil sands production in Canada is expected to double. At Cenovus, we have several projects underway. All are drilled, using steam to liquefy the oil so it can be pumped to the surface. So with drilling being the future of the oil sands, we see ourselves as the next generation oil sands producers. From a single well pad, we can access a huge underground reservoir with relatively little surface disturbance. 80% of the oil sands will eventually be developed with those kinds of techniques. But think of this, just three decades ago, nobody thought that was even possible. Today we're doing it and getting better at it every day. For example, at Cenovus, we've made a number of enhancements to the main technology we use, enhancements that lower the amount of steam needed to produce a barrel of oil, enhancements that will enable us to recycle more of the salty water we use, which is the only water we use, to make the steam, enhancements that enable us to use less natural gas. And we're pretty excited about our most recent technology development. We can now drill a test well in the middle of nowhere without building any access roads. That's because we use a helicopter to fly a specially outfitted rig into the area. So no roads and very little land disturbance. It's called SkyStrat, but that's a pretty difficult thing to remember. So if you plug in flying rig into YouTube, you can see a video showing what SkyStrat looks like and what it's doing out there. It's pretty cool. The people at Synovus come from all parts of the country and the world. We're young. Well, that's not me. We're old. We have kids, and we all want a good future for our grandchildren. The people I work with really care about what we do and how we do it, whether they're accountants, engineers, or environmental specialists. They know Synovus has a responsibility to Canadians to develop the resource responsibly, and they take pride in their role to ensure that happens. So we don't like hearing accusations that Canadians are lax when it comes to the environment, implying that we as a nation have weak morals and soft laws because we're developing the oil sands. This may be my adopted country, but I'm personally affronted by those accusations. We have no reason to be ashamed of how we're developing our natural resources. In fact, we're quite okay with people who push us to do better, because we're pushing ourselves even harder. Javier, our executive vice president of the oil sands, is well known in our company for saying, the status quo is not acceptable. At Synovus, that is how we have come to think about our business. The environment is a key consideration in all that we do at Synovus and as an industry. The status quo is just not acceptable. Take greenhouse gas emissions. It's a hot topic. I'm sure it's going to be discussed a lot over today and tomorrow. And when it comes to the oil sands, there's a lot of misinformation about it. This is the latest number. The oil sands account for 1/700th of the world's emissions. That's the equivalent of about a tablespoon in a 10-liter bucket of water. But at Synovus, we believe even that much is too much. Through technology improvements, we've reduced our greenhouse gas emissions per barrel by 27% since 2004, and we're working on ways to further reduce our emissions, as is everyone else in the oil sands. As was alluded to by the panel, every human activity, whether it's resource development, manufacturing, tourism, home building, even using the latest electronic gadget, has some kind of impact on the environment. It's a fact of life. My point is, we have to come to terms with what impact we're willing to bear for what activity, and to make sure the value that activity creates is worth the impact. Does that mean we don't have to do better? Of course not. Just the opposite. It means we all have to do better at everything. In the oil sands, we're working on improvements every day using innovation and technology. And when we encounter challenges like greenhouse gas emissions, we don't throw up our hands and say, shut it down. We find solutions. I can't tell you that we have all the answers, but I can tell you we're working on them. Synovus has more than 100 technology development projects on the go at any one time, 3/4 of which will have or could have further environmental benefits. And the industry as a whole spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year on technology. Instead of angry debates or vitriolic rants, we need a constructive discussion so we hear all aspects of the story, about the role oil plays in our daily lives, the role companies like Synovus play in producing it, and the role Canada can play in getting it to the people who need it. It's time all Canadians involve themselves as stakeholders of Canada's energy resources, to think more critically, to set aside the stereotypes, to hear what others have to say, and to get the facts before making up their minds, so we can all come to our own conclusions about the issue, about Canada's resource development, about oil. We're doing our part. We've created a video called The Story of Oil and a website that provides additional facts as well as a discussion forum. And we welcome all views on that discussion forum. It's called More to the Story. That's more, numeral two, thestory.com. In closing, I'd like to thank McGill for hosting this conference and bringing together so many different points of view. We're very pleased to have been asked to be a sponsor. Thanks, and I look forward to your questions. I'm just going to ask Brett Harris, a colleague of mine, to come up and join me.
Thank you, Liz. I'll be moderating, and I have two rules when it comes to questions. One is your question must be in the form of a question, and secondly, it's one question per customer. So if I could see if there are any questions. Over here on my left to start with. And we have about 5 or so minutes if I want to keep us on schedule.
Hello, my name is Felix Van Gaia. Really picking up on the constructive debate, we seem to have a politicized debate. So how do we actually have a constructive debate, both for people who need to actually understand more about how we do need oil, but then also how we can actually try and diminish the externalities of it?
Thank you.
Can you hear me? Oh, sorry. I was just saying that it really is quite unfortunate that the debate has become quite so politicized. But first, I want to say that I really don't believe it should be a debate. I feel that it should be a conversation and that everybody's voices should be heard. So in terms of, the landscape is what it is. I think what we have to do is encourage everybody to get informed, to learn about the facts, to really understand what the issues are, what the future of Canada is if we make certain decisions, and to make sure that people understand the consequences of every decision that's before us. So I know it doesn't really answer the question because it's a very difficult question.
All right, so I'm going to clear the people at the mic now, and then we'll go on to our next session. So on my right here.
Hi, my name is Karine Pilofi. I'm a lawyer. My question takes it away from the politics of it and into law. So with governments not taking legislative actions to curb carbon emissions to avoid catastrophic climate change, are you concerned about the risk of climate change litigation coming to Canada like we are starting to see it happen internationally? Then it would no longer be about the cost of mitigation, which we can argue is between $15 and $50 a ton of carbon, but about compensating for damages caused, which would, from what I've read, would range between $200 and $800 a per ton of carbon. And I would like to hear what you think the impact on your financial viability of your business model would be if that were to happen. Thank you.
I can jump in on that one. I mean, it's a pretty speculative question. I guess what I can say is that there's a number of ways that we can deal with the issue of regulating carbon in this economy. I can't really speak to the issue of carbon litigation coming to Canada. We certainly haven't seen it yet. We haven't seen it on a large scale, I don't think, in North America, and I'm not sure that we've seen it on a large scale around the world. What I can say is that there are a number of ways you can deal with it. The federal government is currently working on a set of regulations, as they have done with transportation and with coal. We've been working with them to come up with what we believe would be the best system. And in our view, the best system is something that, we heard reference earlier on to the model that we have in Alberta today. It's a great starting point because we believe that the way that the system should be set up is that any money that is that comes from placing a, whether it's a tax or some sort of a levy on carbon, should go towards technology development that will help us further minimize our carbon emissions. So that's what we've been focused on as a company, that's what we're focused on as an industry, and that's where we think that kind of system should go, and that's exactly the kind of system we have right now in Alberta. So, yeah, I mean, we're waiting to see what the federal government does, and we look forward to seeing those regulations.
Thank you. Darren.
Hi, Darren Barney. I'm a communication studies professor here at McGill. You mentioned that you have findings that suggest that overall media coverage of oil sands development is overwhelmingly negative, and I'm just wondering on what empirical basis Cenovus makes those claims, because the studies that I've been seeing as an academic who works in this area would confirm that conclusion.
So I have to say that the findings that I was talking about came out of the workshops that we did. So they, as I said at the very beginning, they were very qualitative research. It's not so much that it is on a page-by-page, inch-by-inch, column-by-column result. What we're finding is the impression that it's leaving people with. So anything that you're taking from an empirical point of view is likely going to show a more balanced approach. What's happening, though, is that the stuff that is negative has more impact. And so what people are being left with is the impression that there's a huge amount of negativity that's going on out there. What we are finding, though, is that on social media, both the studies that we've done on my own team, is that it is, the negativity is quite overwhelming.
So I'm going to take the three young women. Well, I said I was clearing the mics because we are really pressed for time. I'm sorry. So if the last three individuals there could give your quick questions, and then we'll let our two panelists respond to them in turn. So why don't we, one after another. Good.
Great. Thank you. Sapora Berman. I have a couple of quick questions.
You're starting to violate my one question to a customer rule, but I'll let you.
Well, let me be specific, because I think it might help to get specific. You've said that Cenovus is supportive of solutions. My understanding is that the Alberta government is proposing some water regulations right now that are in draft form, specifically looking at dry tailings ponds, as well as looking at flow from the Athabasca River. And I'm wondering whether Cenovus will support ecosystem scientific-based flow restrictions from the Athabasca River, and whether or not you would support ensuring that no process-affected water is dumped into the Athabasca River, and on the climate regulations, whether you will support a 40-40 carbon tax in Alberta, and how you're minimizing of the climate impacts of oil.
Okay, sands. I think they've got the point. So we've got three questions, so if I can go to the next person.
Hi, my name is Leanne. I'm an MES candidate at York, so a master's candidate. I would just like to say that I agree with two of your points to some degree, that some of us in Canada are very lucky that we have oil and resources and a good economy, and that constructive discussion is necessary and that we need to be better informed. There's a lot of misinformation out there. I would like to maybe just add to that, though, that it's difficult to generalize about being lucky having oil in a country. An example may be Nigeria. Niger Delta, they're not as lucky with their oil. Another thing would be, I know you said that you did workshops. I'm curious about how many Indigenous peoples were involved in those and why we're not really discussing the social issues surrounding treaty rights, especially in the tar sands, because it's on Treaty 8 territory.
Thank you very much.
You get there.
I'll give our guests a chance to respond. Thank you. You've got a question about very specific questions about Alberta regulation and taxation, and a more general question.
Well, let me address the water regulations very quickly. We're really the wrong people to be asking about that. We don't operate anywhere near the Athabasca River watershed. In fact, we don't have tailings ponds, and I think that's a common misconception, is that every oil sands operation has tailings ponds and has large mining operations. Today, 55% of the production that comes from the oil sands comes from operations like ours, where we do drilling. The water that we use for making steam to inject into the ground comes from deep aquifers. It's salty. It's not fit for human consumption. So none of our water would have anything to do with the Athabasca River. So I don't think we can respond directly to that, but we certainly are in favor of strong oversight in terms of water regulations in Alberta, in terms of greenhouse gas regulations, and all environmental regulations.
If I could just talk a little bit about the question about the Aboriginal people being involved in our surveys. So what we did is we handed it over to an independent research firm, and we hired a firm out of, I think it was Toronto, And what we wanted to do is just make sure that they were completely arm's length from anything that has ever gone on in terms of polling the country or looking at research data. Because what we wanted to do was really make sure that we were getting completely sort of non-biased information and their approach to how they were going to do this research. So we had nothing to do with who they asked to be involved. We asked them to do a random sampling in those different areas. So whether or not someone from their ethnicity was a factor, I have to say no, we did not deliberately go in. However, we do a whole lot of polling on a more empirical way on quantitative analysis, in that we do a study every 2 years in our operating areas as well as across the country. And in that study, what we do is make sure that we are sitting down and having an actual conversation, not just a sort of pick up the phone and randomly call people, with all our stakeholders. So that is people very specifically from our Aboriginal communities, very specifically the people who are in the regulatory side, people who are part of the municipalities where we work, so that we really get their views and understanding of what we're doing well, what we're not doing well, what we could do better. So there's a lot of that goes on.
And if I could just add to that, with respect to your broader question about the social issues and treaty rights, obviously treaty rights are complex and difficult issues, and those are ones for the federal government to deal with. What we can do as a company, and what we do is to consult with the First Nations communities that are in the areas where we operate. To date, now, those are long-term consultations that begin before the project, before a shovel ever goes into the ground, and they continue for decades. To date, we've signed 5 long-term agreements. These are decades-long agreements with First Nations communities in the areas where we operate. We also have a policy of hiring and contracting locally. Last year, we spent $327 million with First Nations communities in the areas where we operate, First Nation companies, rather, in the communities where we operate. So there is considerable benefit that goes along with it as well. And I'm not sure that message gets out as much as some of the other messages that we've seen.
Well, thank you very much. We've got another panel that was starting 10 minutes ago, but we're not so bad. So I want to thank you for presenting and thank the questioners. I'm going to ask our next panel to come to the front.